Welcome back from your short break, and we're going to move as quickly as possible into the second panel, which will be moderated by Carolyn Fredrickson of the American Constitution Society, and she will describe it and begin to pose the questions. I only have one thing I want to say, which is that when you comment, please just really quickly say who you are, because not everybody can read everybody else's name tag, and that's it. Carolyn Fredrickson.
Great. Well, thanks so much. So I think this conversation is actually a very natural follow-on from what we were just talking about. I'm going to get a little bit more into the nitty-gritty of the actual system that we have in place. What are the rules that govern it? How do our checks and balances work in the current polarized situation that we have? And how are the three branches contributing to the dysfunction? We're going to look a little bit at the legislative rules and practices, so bore down a little bit on what the Senate and the House actually do. Is there more to be done in the Senate after the nuclear option? The House, which we haven't talked about that much in terms of its own rules. The Supreme Court's obviously a player here, so I hope that we look a little bit at that. There are a number of decisions that have played a role. There are a number of cases pending that may have a significant impact, such as the Noel Cannon case dealing with recess appointments. And then it's not necessarily mentioned directly in this description, but the executive branch. I think we really need to sort of examine, you know, what is the role of the executive branch in, I can definitely say from the nominating side, there have been significant problems in the way that the White House has worked to make its nominations. So with that, I will turn it over to our speakers, but I want to do a brief introduction, and we have some really absolute fabulous people to talk about this. Larry Cohen will start. He's the president of the Communications Workers of America, and I think most critically for this discussion, the founder of the Democracy Initiative, and I know Marissa, who's here with him. I think we should pass this all out. You might look to see the large number of groups that are engaged in that. And I would say that Larry, in particular, was really a driving force in the changes that were made in the Senate to the filibuster rules. And I'm looking forward to hearing his perspective on what else needs to be done there. And we have Eric Lane, who's the dean of Hofstra Law School, was a senior fellow at the Brennan Center, and I think, again, of particular relevance here, particularly as we mentioned, state and local governments was the special counsel to the Speaker of the New York City Council from 2002 to 2005. So perhaps we'll actually look at some, maybe there are functioning governments that might provide models. And Professor Francis Lee, who spoke a little bit in the last panel, who is at the University of Maryland, and a professor of government, is one of the leading experts on Congress, and wrote a book called Beyond Ideology, Politics, Principles, and Partisanship in the U.S. Senate. So I think we're going to have a good discussion there. Joe Onick, who is a dear old friend of mine, who's with the Raven Group, spent quite a number of years on Capitol Hill, was the senior counsel to Speaker Pelosi, worked for Senator Kennedy, clerked for Justice Brennan, and on and on and on. And Jonathan Rauch, who is a senior fellow at Brookings and a contributing editor at the National Journal and at the Atlantic Monthly, and is a prolific author on the topics we've begun to discuss. So I guess, I'd say just from my background, I mentioned quickly in the earlier panel that I spent quite a number of years on the Hill. I was a deputy chief of staff to Tom Daschle, and I was chief of staff to Maria Cantwell. I was up in the Senate during the nuclear option and the Gang of 14. I find this all more fascinating than I should, probably, for my own mental health. But anyway, I think this is going to be a great discussion, and I'd like to turn it over to Larry to start us off.
Okay, great. Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks for pointing out this is on in front of you, the Democracy Initiative. The backside is as interesting as the front, because you see some 40 groups, more than 40 groups, including many in the room, but also groups like Brennan Center have been, Carolyn, huge contributors to the policy that we work off of. And let me just say quickly that my union didn't sort of come to this naturally. As many people mentioned earlier, we came to it because of the obstruction, whether it's a shutdown of the government or more broadly, what our, you know, tens of thousands of active members, hundreds of thousands of members see as really, you know, not what a democracy should look like, to paraphrase Madison of a few years ago. This is not what democracy looks like. And so about 8 years ago, we focused on, this is just as our union really quickly, four key economic issues, broad issues, secure jobs, fair trade, healthcare for all, retirement security, and bargaining and organizing rights. Lots of work leading up to the 110th, 111th Congress on those issues. Came to the 111th Congress, and Speaker Pelosi, who we call best speaker ever, literally, she comes into a CWA room, she's still called that, that everyone starts to chant. So 400 items, most of them legislation, passed in the 111th that didn't get discussed for 1 second on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Not for 1 second. And as Michael talked about earlier, the so-called filibuster, it's really not a filibuster, we shouldn't even call it that. It's just unanimous consent and then the failure to override it in terms of the current Senate rules. It's not the filibuster. It has nothing to do with talking. So anyway, the failure to overcome unanimous consent at an all-time high, as Harry Reid said many times, Lyndon Johnson was majority leader for whatever it was, 5 or 6 years, and there were less than five filibusters. And those were ones where we actually had a talk, but there were less than five times where they couldn't put an item on the floor. And in Harry Reid's first 5 years, there were 400. So we saw that those issues that we had mobilized just in our own organization, hundreds of thousands of people on, you know, passed the Congress and never get debated. Secondly, for our members, and I would say for working people in this country and beyond that, we came to believe the 2008 election was a high watermark. It was no different than 1936. And what was the difference? I mean, there was a difference quantitatively in terms of party makeup. You heard earlier about South, North, and other things. So it gets complicated. But the differences have to do with the way the Senate functioned, but also that linkage between the rollback for the last 20 years on voting rights and the roll-up of money in politics. So last year in that federal election, 435 House seats, 33 Senate, President, Vice President, $7 billion. That's up $1 billion from 4 years earlier. And it's up five times from 20 years earlier. And so for us, we began to see, you know, led by the dysfunction in the Senate, that not only is students in Madison chanted, this is not what democracy looks like, this is really not what democracy looks like. And also, when we looked at it in global terms, it's even worse. So let's just take voter registration. Voter registration in the U.S., on average, state by state, is under 70%. In almost every other democracy in the world, it's in the 90s, if not 100%. The money in politics, there's not numbers like that anywhere else in the world that's called a democracy in terms of the money spent for the handful of elections. Or even in the presidential election, not having national popular vote. That's another item we do work on. But not having national popular vote means that $3 billion gets spent in about six states and the candidates don't even go anywhere else. So that led us to, and I'll put a bunch of these booklets over there, this is sort of our popular education inside our large organization. We've trained almost 50,000 active members. Sometimes they're stewards, sometimes they're just activists, using this. And this is a small pamphlet that helps link the economic issues that people join a union to deal with to the democracy issues. And this is what led us, along with the NAACP, Greenpeace, and the Sierra Club, to launch the Democracy Initiative. And the Democracy Initiative is meant to be staff light, as Marissa will tell you. It's not meant to compete with all the organizations that help create this space. but it is meant to link together these giant membership organizations that collectively have 30 million members to the democracy issues that so many folks here work on. And I think, I mean, for me, as somebody who, as I mentioned earlier, spent my whole life trying to be, as an organizer, as a worker, as an activist, last 9 years as president of this union, it gives me really the most hope that we can create a path, number one, for economic justice in this country, to deal with economic inequality in a fundamental way. And then if we don't do that, if we don't step away from sort of what initially motivated us, and this would be just as true of Mike Broom from Sierra, Phil Radford, Ben Jealous, the others who convened this with me, whether our passion is climate change or civil rights or social justice or bargaining and organizing rights, we have the lowest bargaining and organizing rights at 6% of any country in the world except Colombia. That's the private sector. No matter what our passion is, we don't have a path to deal with it. And when we come to the Senate, and yes, we got a huge breakthrough because only one reason, we had a giant coalition. On July 30th, when those first eight got confirmed, which included a majority on the NLRB, the EPA commissioner, the CFPB director, and the Secretary of Labor, when those eight got confirmed, 2.5 million people had at least made a call into their member of Congress, into their senator, to get that done. And we had reframed that issue from Republican obstructionism to Democrats who don't act. And it's too much, I mean, we heard this before, it's too much about what the Republicans don't do. Yet Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2 makes it very clear of the Constitution that the majority can act and should act and sets its own rules and decides how to proceed. And it's all too convenient for a Senate where senators spend 3 days a week fundraising, and if you're lucky, 3 days a week in Washington, and one day a week getting back and forth. This is when you look at the whole 168 hours in a week.
So Larry, I want to move up to somebody else shortly. So
I just want to... I'm just going to wrap up. It becomes, you know, very clear that if we don't tackle the procedure in the Senate and link it to these other issues, which we'll talk about today, money in politics, voting rights, we really don't have a path to the kind of economic and social justice that motivates so many of us.
Right, thank you. And I would just note that actually the 3 days that they might spend in Washington, they're also fundraising. So,
and you would know.
I would know. So I think it's actually a very great segue into to Professor Lee, who can maybe bring us, put some of this discussion about the Senate and the current sort of gridlock that we face there into some historical context.
Well, in thinking about governing structures as a contributor to government dysfunction, I'll just begin with a basic point that the U.S. system of separation of powers and checks and balances is a means of fragmenting political power. Political parties strive to overcome this fragmentation, but our system remains fundamentally hostile to parties, and it blocks them at every turn. A system of separated powers may have the virtue of preventing tyranny, as the framers argue. It also has the benefit of forcing compromise among important partisan and societal interests, as argued by Jonathan Rauch. But diffusing power also incentivizes irresponsible behavior. In democratic politics, power and responsibility go together. Irresponsibility is understood in democratic politics everywhere as a privilege more open to those with less actual power. As one Democratic House member remarked in 1995, right after the Gingrich Revolution, ain't opposition fun. We don't have to be responsible. All we have to do is watch them self-destruct. Parties that have the power to govern expect to be held responsible for governing failures. But in the U.S., neither parties nor presidents can govern because power is divided in such complex ways. Most of the time, we have divided government, in fact. Politicians who do not have the power to deliver policy outcomes can and will legitimately blame others for failures and for inaction. But this lack of accountability also gives them incentives to behave irresponsibly. What do I mean by responsibility? Responsibility in a democratic politics means acting with a concern for the immediate consequences for public policy. Regardless of whether they are liberal or conservatives, politicians have to decide when to make serious efforts to participate in governance, to achieve the doable at the present moment, to take the half a loaf if you can get it, to pursue incremental reforms, or instead to withdraw in order to preserve or generate issues for future elections. Irresponsible politicians will refuse to engage with the difficult choices that governance requires. They will refuse to grapple with trade-offs or to negotiate. Instead, they wash their hands of the enterprise and use their time in office to set up issues for the next elections. Governing is difficult, to state the obvious. It almost always involves tough, unpopular choices. The policies that are possible in the American system are almost never popular with party-based voters. Think back to Obamacare. It was passed under a unified party government with 60 votes in the Senate for part of the legislative drive. It's the most significant expansion of the social welfare safety net since the Great Society. It was a huge disappointment for the Democratic left. If a disappointment is all that's possible under those circumstances, one shudders to think of the painful choices that politicians face under current circumstances. It's much easier and it's far safer politically to refuse negotiation and just campaign on pie in the sky. All these things are always true in American politics to some extent, but to make matters worse, the incentives for political irresponsibility are far greater today than is normal for American politics. A key reason is the ferocious competitiveness of our political system. You can hardly blame for politicians for focusing on the next elections, for continually focusing on the next elections, when the prospects for change in power are so great. It's important to note that the closeness of today's party competition is decidedly not typical over the course of U.S. history. When you consider the narrow margins of control in both House and Senate, the probability of switches in party control, the closeness of recent presidential elections, you're looking at a system that's far more competitive than is usually the case in American history. We're a long way from the so-called permanent Democratic majorities of the 60s and the 70s, when elections preoccupied politicians far less, there was a lot less to interest them. The last three decades have seen the longest period of near parity in national party competition since the Civil War. This is the root cause of the permanent campaign, the constant messaging activity that engages both parties' leaderships at all times. The period most similar to our own in terms of competition was the Gilded Age after 1876 and before the McKinley election in 1896. This was another period of stalemate and low levels of policy accomplishment. So what to do about it? Separation of powers and its fragmentation of political power encourage irresponsibility, especially under current conditions of intense electoral competition. But Americans love their constitutional system, and I don't think there's any likelihood of significant reform there. But by way of putting some recommendations on the table, I would argue in favor of mechanisms that enhance whatever political responsibility is possible. Strengthening the parties relative to outside groups in campaign finance is probably a good idea. In terms of internal rules, the Senate stands out for its highly unaccountable rules of proceeding. When the Senate fails to act, the minority blames the majority, and the majority blames the minority. At least in the House, for all its problems, you know who to blame. The cloture process has come to be used as a minority party veto. The minority can wield it and then lambaste the majority for failing to govern. So I would advocate for further reforms to move the Senate more towards majority rule. The nuclear option on executive nominations was a step in the right direction. Budget reconciliation and some other streamlined procedures have also been a safety valve that have allowed for some majority rule around the Senate filibuster. Those categories of bills could be expanded, perhaps to appropriations, certainly to the motion to proceed or to go to conference with the House. There are lots of reform ideas out there that would stop well short of making the Senate the House of Representatives. But none of them would be a panacea. But they strike me as the most significant procedural improvements available that could be made to enhance the limited policy accountability that exists in the American political system.
So that was terrific, I think, and also a great opportunity to bring Joe Onnick into the discussion. We've talked a lot about the Senate, and there's always an interest in not making the Senate into the House of Representatives. But the House of Representatives has sort of the opposite problem. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Is there not enough minority influence there instead of having the Senate's problem where you need more majority rule? Maybe the House needs the opposite. Joe, can you talk a little bit about that?
Speaker Boehner faces a fractious Tea Party, and we've discussed it. And what he has decided to do on several occasions, most recently yesterday, is that he's put legislation up and relied primarily on Democrats to vote for the legislation. And this is actually not something new. Some of the most important legislation in American history, recent history, passed with only minority support from the majority party in the House. The Reagan tax cuts passed with a minority of Democratic House votes. NAFTA passed with a minority of Democratic House votes. So it's nothing new. But does it presage a major change? Norm asked earlier that we won't really know that until we see what happens on immigration. And immigration is an issue where I believe, most commentators believe, there are a majority of votes for something like the Senate bill. Virtually all of the Democrats will now vote for it because there are no more Bulldog Democrats. It's a more coherent Democratic contingent. And there are probably 25 to 30 Republicans who, for a combination of conviction and also pressure from agricultural and business interests, who would clearly vote for similar legislation. But will Mr. Boehner put it on the floor? We've been reading recently about the extraordinary heat and divisions in the Republican Party, and I think it's quite likely that he won't put it on the floor. There's one other issue where there's probably a majority of members ready to vote, but it's unclear that they'll be able to, and that's in the area of intelligence surveillance, in particular the collection of metadata, bulk metadata. There probably is a majority based of libertarian Republicans and a variety of Democrats who could pass the bill, the Sensenbrenner or Leahy bill, or other bills that would basically end the bulk surveillance. Here, unlike immigration, where Mr. Boehner may be for the changes, but I think the party may be too divided, here the problem probably is that Mr. Boehner and others in the leadership, Chairman Rogers and the Intelligence Committee, would be against the changes, so again, it's not going to be put on the floor. So what happens in the House, or what can happen, when there are inchoate majorities, but the leadership won't bring them to the floor? There is one mechanism, the discharge petition. Somewhat unwieldy, but if you can get 218 members majority to call for a discharge petition, you can put legislation on the floor. There are waiting periods, 30 days or more. There's an arcane that you can only, it's only privileged on the second and fourth Monday of a month. So it's not easy, and it doesn't work for very fast-moving things like budget deals. But it is at least a possibility. And it has been used in recent political history. In fact, it was used in the House version of McCain-Feingold, Shea's the House version of McCain-Feingold was, and it only used one time explicitly, but of course it always is a threat. If in fact you have a petition going and you begin to get over 200 votes, you may force the leadership to act without actually discharging the petition. So one of the things I'm thinking about is, will that happen here, either with immigration or the intelligence surveillance? I think the answer is no in either case. It's unlikely to happen on immigration because the 25 to 30 Republicans who support immigration reform nevertheless are unlikely to want to betray the leadership. Whenever you do a discharge petition, it is a betrayal of your leadership because you take control out of their hands and you put it in the hands of whoever the advocates are of the particular legislation. It's hard for me to think that those 25, 30 Republicans, the more moderate Republicans in the caucus, who need Mr. Boehner to protect them and help them in their own battles with the extreme Tea Party elements, are going to betray Mr. Boehner on immigration if he should decide, as I think he probably will, that it's too divisive to bring up. Surveillance. I have a feeling that it also would never really, that there will never be a discharge petition for two reasons. One, even if it passed the House, it isn't going to pass the Senate. Feinstein and others would kill it. And secondly, and probably more important, the provisions that support this bulk surveillance, Section 215 of the Patriot Act, is sunsets on June 1, 2015. So if the House, people who want it, just do nothing, it will die unless the administration can come up with legislation that is agreeable to them. So my guess is neither of those will work. But what about in the future? Is there a future for the discharge petition as a new mechanism in American politics, given the strange and current configuration that we have? I think, and is there a way to improve it? One possibility, prior to 1993, the discharge provision was secret. And the petition was secret until it was discharged. When it was discharged, of course, all the people's names were on the list were there. But of course, then you had safety in numbers. You know, you wouldn't want to be the first Republican to sign a discharge petition now because it's totally public. And of course, tremendous pressure will put on you. If your name is not going to reveal until many of your colleagues have joined you, you might be willing to do it. Now, whether this goes totally against the transparency sort of ideas of the age, maybe it's a non-starter, but at least it might be worth thinking about. The other thing, of course, would be to shorten the waiting period. If, in fact, you could actually do a discharge petition and get it on the floor on a privileged manner very quickly, 5 days, 7 days after the discharge, instead of having to wait for a much longer period, that might make it more effective. I do think that the discharge petition is the one way to effectuate majoritarian, a way to effectuate majoritarian rule in the House, and is something we should look at. There's been a lot of talk, and I'll just quickly end here, about strengthening the parties and their money, and that might have an impact, and I think that may be true, but let's not forget that Mr. Boehner does a lot of that himself. In the last election cycle, he raised $70 million for candidates. And in this cycle, he's already raised $54 million. So he, to some extent, basically the Republican campaign committee, does perform that function. Obviously, the strength of that function has been undermined by the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, which allows so much other money to flow in that neither Mr. Boehner on his side, or for that matter, Pelosi on her side, as much money as they can raise, they cannot, in fact, close out candidates who they don't want to run.
So, thanks, Joe. I think those are some very interesting points, and I'm glad you brought us back to the money in politics piece and how that plays and sort of in breeding dysfunction. I'd like to bring Jonathan Rauch into the discussion, who has the very hopefully titled book, Rescuing Compromise. So can we rescue compromise with maybe some of the rules changes that have been suggested? How do we actually get those changes made?
Well, thank you. Special thanks to Mark Schmidt. When I wonder why I'm invited here, I think there are actually two reasons why I'm here. One is, as we say in journalism, if it's catered, it's news. And second, Mark knows he can always count on me to put a cat among the pigeons, which I'm about to try to do, by particularly addressing the donor community here and saying that to a large extent what we have going on now, both on the Hill and then the system generally, is a crisis of followership more than a crisis of leadership, and that it's time for a lot of people, especially people in the progressive reform community, to reorient their thinking to get their minds around that, because I think a lot of what's going on now has become counterproductive. Why do I say that? Something we've heard and will hear more of is the system's sharp turn in a parliamentary direction, but unfortunately that's only one-third true. We do have essentially parliamentary parties voting pretty much solidly along party lines consistently and never across them, But there are two other legs of a parliamentary system which we lack. One is parliamentary accountability, which Francis Lee just so ably spoke about. As Woodrow Wilson so memorably put it, the voters don't know which boy to whip, and that's a function of divided government. That's not something we can do something about in the short term. There is, however, a third leg of parliamentary system which we can do more about, I think, and that's party discipline. John Boehner's problem is that he's, until the Hastert rule goes down, which it may have, he's got to get everyone in his party to vote for him, but he has no way to make them do that. Of course, in a real parliamentary system, you whip your troops, and if they don't vote the way you want them to, they're out, unless it's a free vote. He has nothing like that. Anyone know the name George Washington Plunkett? I know Norm does. I'm assuming any others? Everybody in the room? So I don't have to explain to you who Plunkett was and why I think he's one of the great political sages. And I think it's time for a second look at Plunkett's teaching. He was a Tammany Hall hack. His claim to fame was holding four public jobs simultaneously and drawing three public salaries. And he used to argue that the political machines were very important because you had to have parties that were able to get people to follow, and for that you had to have patronage. And he argued for what he called honest graft. And that is a patronage system in which bribery and corruption is not lining people's pockets as individuals, it's helping parties get the votes they need to make things run. What we've done in the last 30 to 40 years of progressive reform is systematically dismantle pretty much all of the tools that were used by party machines to enforce discipline and get followership going. And it turns out getting people to follow is really, really, really hard. And that's where I think it would be very interesting and important for the folks in this room to start reorienting their thinking about, okay, maybe we've gone too far, and it's time to push that pendulum back and try to think about strengthening political machines rather than weakening them, making it easier for party leaders to lead and punish those who defy them. What kind of things are we talking about? I'll throw some things out here. You'll hear more about three of them. One of them, I think, will be deeply controversial. Happens to be the most important. Number one, earmarks should not have been gotten rid of. I'm proud to say I made that point in 2007. I suppose slim solace these days, but earmarks are an important tool that party leaders need in order to govern. They should come back if they can. Transparency has gone too far. We just heard about that in the context of discharge petitions. It's also true in the context of far too much has to be done in public. Primary elections, which were supposed to empower people, turn out to empower weird little sects that run them, and party bosses should be able, in many cases, to nominate candidates over the wishes of a primary electorate. We need to retreat on some of those reforms. There are various ways to do that. California is experimenting with an interesting one. There are others. It's less democratic in some sense, but I think more democratic in the sense that you get stronger party directions. Finally, the one that at least some in this room will disagree with, contribution limits are no longer useful. They are counterproductive. In the world we now live in, they're driving money underground out of the accountable hands of candidates and parties and into the hands of the Koch brothers. We should either give up on contribution limits altogether because they no longer serve any rational purpose, or we should raise them to the point where it's like $10 million for a presidential campaign, $1 million for a Senate, and $100,000 for the House. Particularly, we should lift contribution limits on parties so that party leaders can steer money, especially in these primary and nominating races. I'd like to get my progressive friends to understand that these days contribution limits are an old idea which have outlived their usefulness and are in fact empowering the bad guys to push the money out of sight of public. But let's generally think, I'd suggest, about ways to move back in the direction of political machines. And I'd argue, actually, we have something to learn from the wisdom of our grandfathers here.
So that was a lot of red meat in front of a bunch of folks who work on campaign finance issues. I'd have to say I'd like to consider what impact that has on the diversity of our elected officials, who aren't very diverse as it is, but I wonder how that kind of may play into that. Maybe that could be part of the discussion. I'd like to turn to Eric Blaine now. How do you react to some of these suggestions? Do we need another Tammany Hall?
Well, let me address two things.
In New York,
We have no limits on campaigns, plenty of earmarks, no transparency, primary elections, and we have probably the most dysfunctional state legislature in America, as we've written at the Brennan Center, and let me testify to that. I was the chief counsel of the Senate Democrat for 6 years, where I learned how bad things could work. So I'm not sure that your prescription entirely works, plenty of bosses too. But what I really want to do is address something that Larry Cohen was talking about. So Larry Cohen said that people would not recognize American democracy now. And as he was saying that, I was thinking to myself, how do people know what American democracy should look like? And I say that with the particulars. I was once a fellow at the Brennan Center, and during my fellowship there, myself and a woman named Meg Marnett got a nice grant and conducted a poll of 1,000 registered New Yorkers to test their levels of civic literacy. And I probably know, not unexpected to you, 60% of them didn't know the name of either senator, including Senator Schumer. I think that's probably has some nice irony to it. 40% didn't know what a legislative body does. And talking about a filibuster, that would be laughable. And in fact, if you look over this report, which you can get from the Brennan Center, you will realize that if we put average registered voters in New York or a self-selecting group, they're, you know, probably no more than the non-registered voters. If you put them in this room, they wouldn't understand one word that we were saying. And to me, whenever we talk about reform and structural reforms and the Senate, I just keep coming back to the fact that out of my own experience in politics, books I wrote with Abner Mikva on the legislative process, books I've written on the Constitution, raising money for politics, participating in politics, I keep coming back to the thought that there's no way to create a vigorous, meaningful democracy when we have a system where, when we have almost no one in the nation that understands the functions of government or our particular democracy. And this is even particularly far worse. I listen to people talk, why don't we have diversity? How are working people going to participate in the process? If you put the screen of working people or minorities across the poll that we took or other polls that have been taken, you will be shocked, absolutely shocked. And maybe people don't think that was important. I mean, the entire reason we have public schools is for civic education. And, you know, every framer talked about civic literacy as the most important thing we can do for a vigorous democracy. And back then, they were pretty educated. There were only a few of them that voted, but they knew a lot about what they were doing. But now that's not true. And they're, you know, so if I'm looking for the one reform that's going to make a real difference in our democracy, the reform I look to is forcing, and this is a state issue, schools to reinvigorate a commitment or to recreate their historical commitment, and it was true, to educating people about what government is intended to do, what is a democracy, so that when someone, you say vote, they know what you mean, and they, when you know, it's not that, you know, or what the system is or what we're talking about, that they have context so they'll want to participate. And the culprit here is clearly the school systems in this country, clearly the school systems, more accelerated greatly recently by No Child Left Behind and Race to the Bottom in New York State. This was 20 years ago, the state that was characterized continuously as the model state to teach civics. We do one course on government in 12th grade. We have just gotten rid of 4th and 8th grade assessment tests, on government, we don't give it anymore. As multiple teachers who have been polled have said, no test, no teach. The national, I just heard that the State Department of Education is either has or is in the process of giving up their every 4 year assessment of civic education, civic literacy of the population as a whole, and the talk is that the numbers have been so bad, and you can find them on the web, they are terrible, that they don't want to test it anymore, particularly in light of all of the emphasis now on science and language and mathematics. So I would say to you that it's all fine, we can change all of these things, I totally support it, but on the other hand, if we're not addressing this issue, I do not think that it is possible to realize the democracy dream that many of us, and certainly at the Brennan Center, where I had a wonderful period, spent a wonderful part of my career, have for a rigorous democracy. And so that goes away.
Right. Well, actually, I think you've given a great opening to Larry Cohen to talk about his little the pilot project of the members of CWA and engaging them. We heard that working people, voters, nobody really knows anything about our government. You got people to care about the filibuster. I mean, that's pretty astounding. How did you do it?
So we linked it to issues they cared about. And the way we got 2.5 million people engaged in that, again, at a minimal level, that's the number that at least made one phone call, is, linking it to what these agencies do. So people who were fighting their own foreclosures, the financial reform movement saw, Cordray not getting 2 years in recess and his term about to run out. Our members saw the end of the National Labor Relations Board, and we linked that to what does that mean if you have collective bargaining and there's no agency to enforce it. What does it mean for 80 million workers who have nowhere else to go? So they got engaged on that level, but they're also engaged in terms of Merkley's Senate Resolution 4, which is unfinished business. We got up into the high 40s, couldn't get 50 votes, intend to come back on that next year. And I would say to, independent voters, Republican voters, most of our members at this point believe, who are engaged in this, it's not all the members, that's a bipartisan issue. And when Tom Harkin first worked on his own version, it wasn't Merkley. Merkley's version is 41 have to show up and they have to talk and they have to stay there or the majority rules. So it does not eliminate the filibuster. But I think the key, for us or for Greens who link it to climate change passed in the 111th never got discussed. It's the linkage of how the democracy works to things that are key in everyday life. And improving everyday life, if we want to be more emotional about it, key to the American dream, as people might see it.
Mm-hmm. So I want to take us back a little bit to some of the things that Jonathan had brought up, because Francis, you also mentioned strengthening parties. Do you think that what Jonathan suggested was those were good ideas? Or do you have other alternatives apart from re-empowering party bosses?
Kind of a hard question. I mean, the end of earmarks reflects not just the efforts of reform organizations like represented in this room, but is part of a longer-term effort on the part of elements of the Republican Party to stop appropriators from negotiating across party lines. This dates back to the 80s, to use appropriations as an opportunity to draw clear lines between the parties, to stop the Republicans who were then in the minority from participating in the appropriating process, getting some share, and then going and supporting the majority party on the floor with appropriations. So there's a partisan strategy that played a role in this whole debate, and so I don't see it as something that was an anti-party move per se. Now, I don't disagree that it plays out in some respects in this way, but it has to do with prohibition on bargaining that is pursued in the name of drawing clear distinctions for purposes of taking issues to the voters in the next elections, and that I see is really distinctive about our contemporary congressional politics, that constant eye to the next election and setting up issues. Like how many votes we take in the House and in the Senate where there's absolutely no sense that that the initiative could become law. They're not. This is not a lawmaking effort. This is public relations on the floor of the House and the Senate, and that's what they primarily do now. And you know, so I see that as part of that broader problem of you know competition in an environment of continuous uncertainty about the future of existing majorities.
I know Joe wanted to jump in here.
Well, I think in terms of giving more money to the parties, I have no problem with that. But as I pointed out, Mr. Boehner is the leader, obviously, of the fund, raises a lot of money. The problem is that under Citizens United, there is no limit to the amount of money that outside groups, whether the Koch brothers or others, can put into the system, so that even though he will raise, my guess is close to $100 million in that cycle, and it will have some influence, I'm sure, it doesn't have as much influence as you might think. There is so much money sloshing around. So I think you probably would still want some limits on spending outside the party, otherwise the party simply won't have a sufficient monopoly. I think that if you want to focus on parties, it does suggest that when you're doing reform, you don't do the kind of reform, at least of public finance, of matching candidate contributions. You instead do the suggestions of Ackerman and other of Patriot dollars, of giving everybody $50 and saying they can use it anywhere, because then the parties could compete for that $50, and a lot of people might send their $50 not to an individual candidate, but might send it to the party, and that would have the impact that you might want of giving the party greater power. So as you have that discussion later on various ways, if you're going to have public financing, that would push you away from the matching grant to the other forms of public finance.
Well, now I think we have to bring Michael Waldman into this conversation, the important discussion around public financing and the different models that might have a role here.
Oh, that wasn't what I was going to ask about. But I do have a question to put a little more texture for the panelists and others. So throughout, certainly the 20th century, the great fight in Congress and both the Senate and in the House was not only between party leadership versus the leadership versus a rambunctious mass of party members, but really between the leadership and the party caucus and the committees. And I used to be a lobbyist in Washington in the 1980s for a consumer group, and what's really striking to me, the difference now, is the disappearance of the committees and the other structures that existed then in a meaningful way, whether it's as investigators holding hearings, as forums for creating new legislation, or as decision-making bodies. They were a rival power source, both to the Speaker of the House, or also to King Caucus, as it used to be called. So I'm wondering what people think about the breakdown in the budget process, the committee structures, and all those kinds of things, which used to be what members of Congress spent their time on. How important is it, and is it recoverable in any way, and are there changes that we don't know about that could make a difference there, other than willpower?
I think I'm looking at Norm, who seems to want to jump in here.
Well, just quickly on the last point, and then I want to raise a couple of other issues. We're seeing a slight movement back, Michael. After what was the most disquieting thing for me, which is a farm bill brought to the floor that had broad bipartisan support in the House, and Frank Lucas watched as 9 committee chairs voted against that bill, which suggested that even the committee chairs are completely out of control when it comes to trying to get back some sense of committee integrity. But we did eventually get a farm bill that passed, and the budget agreement that Paul Ryan and Patty Murray put together is another sign. But then on the other side of that is they put together this deal, and it includes as a critical element modest pension reform for the military, and now virtually everybody is piling on to undo that. So it suggests that delicate compromises that you put together, where in a small group you can do something that's controversial, you can't even hold on to that. So we're a ways away from it. Just a couple of quick points. On the parliamentary system, there are a few things that ought to be noted here. One is, almost every parliamentary country now is going through its own deep dysfunction and crisis of leadership. This is a global phenomenon that's partly because of the structural difficulties in economies, and also for Europe, I think, the deep problems that emerge as you undo a welfare state that people saw as an entitlement that was God-given, and it's difficult, and we're seeing pernicious forces emerge. But what's also true is if you yearn for a parliamentary system, look at what they've done with their economies. They make decisions and carry them out. They keep making stupid decisions and take them in a further in a wrong direction. But there's one other point, which is if you're going to have a parliamentary system, you need a culture that gives legitimacy to the decisions made, even for those who don't like them. And here I want to quote the person most missed to me in our political discourse today, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. I got my opportunity, Liz, who made the observation frequently among many other insightful ones, we don't do broad social policy change without broad bipartisan leadership consensus. That's our culture. The fact is, for the first 2 years of the Obama administration, even with the filibuster being used in the fashion it was, unlike ever before, we had a dramatic set of policy accomplishments achieved. But in our culture, half the system saw them as legitimate, illegitimate, and continue to try to delegitimize them. So we can't, even if we could wave a magic wand and give us parliamentary structures, it would take decades or longer to build in a culture that would accept that, dysfunctional as that would be. And then just a point on the money issue. First of all, the misconception, which is deeply embedded in much conventional wisdom now, that McCain-Feingold and other reforms weaken parties, it's simply wrong. The fact is, soft money didn't strengthen parties. It was money, as the Brennan Center research showed very vividly, that was just channeled through the parties. They were basically shell actors, and it went into ads that didn't even mention parties. They were used for other purposes. We actually, in the process of implementing those reforms, did strengthen parties. The Democratic Party built a small donor base for the first time ever because of what happened with those changes. It is Citizens United, Speech Now, and what's likely to happen that will give you what you want, Jonathan McCutcheon, unlimited party contributions. And we will see the new Gilded Age that makes the old Gilded Age look modest by comparison. Libertarians are going to look at government actors shaking down big donors who have no ability to say, hey, I've maxed out. And you're going to see the power of government used in illegitimate ways. Corruption will increase dramatically. There are ways to strengthen parties that don't involve eliminating contribution limits. The work that Michael and his colleagues and I did that would give unlimited sums to parties if they raise them from small donors in an appropriate way is a way of doing that. But the fact is, if we wanted to do one thing in that front, it would be a generous retirement fund for Anthony Kennedy.
I more than second that. So Larry wants to come into this conversation.
Well, really with a question for all of the people who are talking about parties, so far be it from me. I've been making the argument that we need to strengthen parties since the late 1980s, early 1990s, when I was being laughed at, I should say. But the question that I would have is, that argument was different today than it was then, because the last 20 or 30 years have radically changed the parties already. So when people talk about strengthening parties, the question is, we don't have party leadership like we had in the 19th or early, or even through the middle of the 20th century. The people that you would be giving the power to in strengthening parties are going to use it in very different ways, right? There are not those kind of professional party bosses who care modestly about ideology, but more about winning than anything else, and so are willing to play a moderating role and so on. So the question would be, in strengthening parties, how are you going to change the parties to make them play the kind of responsible role that they can play when they are structured a particular way? And what are the ideas? Because I haven't heard anything about that. Just reversing some of the things that weaken parties and re-strengthening the parties we have today would, my guess is, make things much worse.
Great. Well, I'm going to ask Steve to step in.
Mark.
Oh, sorry, Mark.
Thanks. I just want to, going back to the congressional structure question, I want to just add a layer of nuance, which is that there are kind of two different things that happen. There's the congressional procedures writ large, as we often talk about them, and then there's budget world. And they operate quite different. Sometimes people talk about the 50-vote Senate versus the 60-vote Senate, and they're different cultures. And one of the places in which we traditionally would find the broad bipartisan acceptance would be those big budget summits. If you took those out of the history of the last 30 years, it would all look pretty dysfunctional, with a few exceptions. What's happened in, I kind of want to suggest this as an area for further research, because I don't think we carve it out in the way that we ought to. What's happened, you know, why is it impossible to, obviously Obama has spent a large portion, probably wasted a large portion of his presidency trying to get that, you know, Andrews Air Force Base thing together again, and a large part of the, you know, a large movement within the Republican Party, it always felt like actually never go back into that room. But how do you, you know, the budget process is supposed to force that kind of room, and why didn't it? I just want to lay that out there as something that we ought to be thinking about a little more.
I just want to add to that that Mark and I were just talking a little bit about how when we talked about the role, the work that, say, Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch did together, or Senators McCain and Feingold, it wasn't just that they could actually collaborate on a piece of legislation, they actually liked each other. And I wonder if just as in the idea of working towards possible solutions, a lot of the fundraising time that senators now engage in so heavily and House members takes away from whatever collegiality they used to have, and they used to have dinner together and so forth. And some state legislatures actually ban fundraising during the session. I mean, is that something that we could talk about that might actually lead to some greater give and take between members? But calling you. I can't read your name. Oh, it's Gary. Gary.
In the one topic that hasn't specifically been discussed, but been sort of danced around in the three decades that I've been dealing with Congress, I've seen a huge shift in Congress looking at its prerogatives, that is, thinking of itself as a legislative body vis-a-vis the executive. And it comes out as an oversight. There used to be much more in the way of hearings, much more thoughtful oversight, responsibilities, and it seemed to cut across party, not always, but today it's all basically a show. Hearings aren't really meaningful hearings. They're witnesses that are basically for the majority. And so I'm curious, those of you who are sort of leading this discussion, didn't quite directly go to that oversight responsibility and an oversight role and how it's changed. And I'm curious why that was or is, and what solutions there are.
We haven't heard from anyone in the back, especially maybe on some campaign finance questions. How does money play?
I'd actually like to ask Jonathan to say a little bit more. He threw that out there as red meat, but I think given the session after lunch is on money and politics, you give people a little more to chew on, it would be good. Because I know the suggestion is thrown out there as controversial, but if you could expand on the reasons, that would be better. I think that would be helpful.
Contribution
limit? So getting rid of them, yeah.
There are real experts in this room, Michael Melvin and Norm Ornstein, and they know far more about the nuts and bolts than I will. So I feel more confident talking about the general idea behind what I'm proposing, which is that to make things happen, party leaders have to be able to discipline their forces, and to do that they need to have some pretty serious weapons of intimidation. Some of those will look corrupt to outsiders, and they'll involve things like saying, "I'm yanking your money." In response to Joe's point, $70 million, that's nothing. That is nowhere near enough. You got to give him much more powerful tools than that, and I think that means you got to have big inflows of money into the parties and party ability to control it. That'll have downsides. I freely agree with Nora about that. There's stuff we don't like about it, but I would challenge my progressive friends. We don't live in the same world as when McCain-Feingold was passed. The Supreme Court has done what it's done, and unless you're getting a constitutional amendment through anytime soon, you've got to deal in a world with the Koch brothers. They have changed everything. The amount of outside money that Koch can go in is unlimited and will remain unlimited effectively. I firmly predict that. And that means that the best option is to try to get rid of the black money by channeling more of that money to the accountable actors, which are parties and candidates. Transparency in terms of disclosure is important there. People need to know where the money's coming from. But at least that way, instead of having the Koch sneak around in dominating races, you'll be able to have the party structures swing in to defend someone like Mitch McConnell with a big ad buy and a lot of money and a lot of help and a lot of other tools, and they'll be able to raise those monies in, frankly, the unattractive large lumps that makes fundraising doable. If you're chasing small donors all the time, you don't have time to compete with the Koch brothers. So I'm suggesting it's a different world, and that contribution limits no longer in this world can play the role that we once hoped they would, which is being a sort of traffic cop to keep all the money inside the system. I don't know if that's helpful.
You know, one thing that I'd love people to comment on is we haven't talked very much about the Supreme Court. The 5-4 decisions we're talking about, changing the composition of the court would perhaps be easier than passing a constitutional amendment. And we talked about term limits a little bit, but presidential elections can do that. So I just want to put that on the table, that maybe the Supreme Court itself should be looked at and how much power it has in our system of government. Michael.
We will talk a lot about this after lunch, so I don't want to take a lot of time out. But if I completely agree that money to parties would be good, okay? I completely agree that parties should be allowed to spend unlimited amounts in coordination with candidates, as Norm said, provided it comes from small donor money. I completely disagree. One, that unlimited contributions do not come together with the kind of corruption that usually involves the leader twisting the donor's arm, as opposed to, but there's a definite agenda price. Two, I don't think most of the people who are funding the independent groups are necessarily interested in getting to the parties. Koch brothers are interested in taking over the party, not in supporting the existing organization. Three, I don't think there's any conflict between raising small contributions and courting large donors. You don't raise small donors the same way. Four, therefore, and this is something I would have said later, I would say now, therefore, I support the idea of matching funds for small contributions to parties and other things that would stimulate a healthy inflow of money to the parties. Having said that, I want to ask the question that I really wanted to ask by raising my hand, which gets back to Gary's question, and I'll probably toss it over to Francis for an answer. The one generational change that we've seen in Congress is that people used to get positions of power for showing institutional responsibility and caring. They tended to, you would not get on certain committees unless you showed that. This has been switched to a system where all of the appointment power is based upon the electoral support that contestants for chairmanships and other chairs and other party positions now show. But it's not about showing institutional responsibility. The groups making the power don't exactly have the independent ability to withstand. On one hand, you're empowering Speaker Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, but on the other hand, Boehner's running scared. So I'm not sure what the solution is, which is what Larry's interested in hearing. I am sure that changing the appointment power, which really looked like a great idea at the time, and certainly getting rid of seniority is the only way to deal with it was a good idea. I'm not sure what can be put in place, essentially to make concern for the institution and for the country the basis for giving real power positions to people. And maybe I'm sure that Frances has thought about this. That's why I'm hoping she'll speak next.
And last.
Right. This will be our last comment.
Just on the point of changes in committee power versus leadership power also goes to the issue of the decline of oversight. That you get appointed to chair a committee now, not by virtue of seniority, but by virtue of your ability to be useful to the leadership, especially in raising money. You put people on committees to help them get reelected. So Democrats put a whole lot of their members from swing districts on the Financial Services Committee, which enables them to raise money, even if it makes financial regulatory reform a whole lot harder. But there's a again, I think this traces back down to the knife's edge politics that we inhabit today. That the insecurity that the majority party feels about holding on to the majority, and the minority's belief that they can get it back. And so the leadership is primarily preoccupied with winning power or holding on to power in this environment. And so committees have been brought to heel in the service of that. The oversight power has been brought to heel in the service of that. And you know, it's hard to see a way out of it beyond a really decisive election that gets us beyond our current stalemate.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Carolyn. We will now go to lunch, which is a buffet outside. We can eat back at our desks here. And we will, at 11, at 1:45, we will start talking about money and politics for real.